and subject matters, all of which are in brochures, some of which are on your table, some of which you'll see on the board here, and many of which you have used, but they're all available online, either directly through the Institute's website or through the League of California Cities or CSAC's website. And the program that we have today emerges out of one of those program areas, which we'll tell you about in just a minute. But before we start, I want to just thank two of our sponsors. First, Comcast, and Sam, where is Sam? Here is Sam, right? That's from Comcast, Sam Rodriguez, and his team of people from Comcast, who are major sponsors for this lunch today. So thank you, Comcast. And I also want to thank the Knight Foundation, who was also a sponsor of this. Is anyone here from the Knight Foundation? I didn't see anyone in the room from the Knight Foundation, but in absentia, let's give them a hand as well. Now, I know we always have a quiz at these events, and I think Joanne went around and talked to every table about the quiz. So finish up those quiz sheets on your table, and our staff, raise your hands back here, Vanna White, and we'll be coming around and collecting the sheets, and we'll be announcing the winner of the trivia contest at the end of our lunch. Also, I think on every table for at each place is a gift from the Institute, which is a screen cleaner, a computer screen cleaner. So is that the one that's in the little green box? So please feel free to take that home with you. So at this time, I would like to introduce our featured speaker of the day. And I know you're still all arguing about who won at your table, but let's go ahead and begin with our speaker. For all of those, you can hear me. When I count down to one, let's just do what we do when we say to our children, be quiet. One, two, three. Shh. Thank you very much. Dr. Peter Shane is our speaker today, and he's a world-renowned expert in a field which touches on things which we talk about all the time, which is how do we communicate with people about the things that are important, and in particular, how do we communicate in an information age about what goes on with local government? How do we touch people in their lives where they live and connect it to the governance of their community? What are the things that are changing in that dynamic? What are the paradigm shifts that are occurring that are different than what we thought they used to be in the days when we may have been running for office? Where are they going to be in the future? Peter is the Jacob Davis and Jacob Davis Chair in Law at Ohio State University at the Moritz College of Law. Peter is a graduate of Harvard University and also of Yale Law School. And he's been in a whole variety of activities in the federal government as well as in the private sector that goes all the way back to when he began teaching full-time in 1981 at the University of Iowa. More importantly, he has, in 2008 and 2009, served as the executive director of the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities in a Democracy, and was the leading drafter of its report, which is called Informing Communities, Sustaining Democracy in a Digital Age. And I think, yes, I saw a copy of that down here. Here's a copy of it. And are copies of this available if people would like to get copies? It's online. Okay, you can go online and get a copy of this book. He's author of numerous other books, including Democracy Online, most recently, Connecting Democracy, Online Consultation on the Future of Democratic Discourse. Peter is serving as a visiting scholar in the Federal Communication Commission's current study on the future of media in the digital age. So without further ado, may I introduce you to Professor Peter Shane.
Thank you very much. Now, of course, we have to figure out how to get the other slides up here, which I think. You've now done. First, I want to express my very deep appreciation for the opportunity to speak with you today. I think it takes enormous courage to be a local government official in the United States today, and maybe even more so in California. I was saying to Hal that as somebody born in New York, I was proud of living in perhaps the most dysfunctional state government in the Union, and apparently a number of other states decided to contest that that prize, and I won't opine on who the winner is, but I know that whether you're an appointed or an elected official, you're facing enormous challenges, and I very much appreciate that you would take the time to be here, and I hope that something that we will share today will be of value to you. The other thing that I just want to say sort of autobiographically is that I'm not a technologist or a media consultant by trade. I'm a constitutional law professor. And the way I got into this was that in the early 90s, friends of mine said, look, if you aspire to say sensible things about the future of democracy, you really have to learn something about telecommunications. You have to learn something about the Internet. This is the direction in which the world is going. And for a variety of reasons, I became especially interested in the way in which governments, and originally, I have to say, more outside the United States than inside the United States, were starting to use the Internet to allow the public to become more directly engaged in actual government policymaking. Now, this turned out to be a hugely important bit of advice from my friends. It had an enormous effect on my research agenda, but it also had the great benefit of allowing me occasionally to be invited to speak to groups of non-lawyers. And the real advantage of this is that, and if you are a lawyer, you know, you have to promise not to tell, I get to share my favorite lawyer joke, which non-lawyers tend to appreciate more. I don't know why. So it's a story about a lawyer, an engineer, and a doctor who go into a bar. Stop me if you've heard this. And they're having a debate as to who among them is practicing the oldest profession. And the doctor looks at the engineer and the lawyer and says, look, you know, I know you guys are you're heathens, you're non-believers, you don't know anything about the Bible, but I really believe in the Bible as the literal word of God. And in Genesis, it said that from Adam's rib did God fashion women. Now, that's an act of surgery. That conclusively demonstrates that medicine is the oldest profession. And the engineer looked at him and said, what's all this? I believe in the Bible as much as you do. But way before Eve got created, before Adam got created, from out of the chaos did God create the universe. You know, separated the land from the sea, the light and the dark. You know, from out of the chaos, he created the universe. That is an act of engineering, clearly older than medicine. And the lawyer just smiled and said, and who do you think created the chaos? I think a lot of people who do what you do for a living feel themselves to be living in chaotic times. I don't think it's all the lawyer's fault, but maybe we had a hand in it. What I'm hoping to do today is to talk about emerging trends in government information initiatives, government efforts to use new media to do a variety of things. And what I'm hoping is that in the short time we have together, I can leave you with both a framework for thinking about why you might be doing what you're doing, or why you might want to do what you're doing a little differently, and also give you some examples of how things are being done inventively, sometimes in your state and sometimes in others. A lot of the ideas that I'll be building on are ideas from the Knight Commission report. I have a long history of being associated only with things with horribly long and infelicitous names. We struggled to come up with a good acronym for this. There, believe me, there was none. But the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities in a Democracy was actually set up, it was organized by the Aspen Institute, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C. They received a big grant from the Knight Foundation to organize a group of distinguished people from the worlds of media, public policy, community building, to answer three enormous questions. One question is, what are the information needs of communities in a democracy? One question is, are those needs being met in the United States today? And the third is, if the answer is no, or at least only in an incomplete way, what can we do about it? And as I said, a number of the ideas that I'll be talking about are really developed in my own mind through my work with the commission. This report is downloadable from that website. If you would like an autographed hard copy, you can contact me. I'll be happy to send you one. But one of the things that the commission really started with in terms of organizing its own thinking was focusing on this question. And you can find a million quotes going back to James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, about how central information is to the working of self-government. But people, on one hand, are willing to take that on faith, but don't always focus on what it is we actually get out of information. What is it that communities need information to do for them? And the commission focused on four needs, one of which is the basic need of coordination. Just getting people to be where they need to be to get some community function accomplished. Sharing information is a way that helps us to accomplish collectively as communities more than we could do individually. So that's an important function. Another obviously critical function is problem solving. The sharing of information is critical to setting a community's agenda, identifying not only the problems, but the options for addressing those problems, weighing the different options, deciding what the pluses and the minuses would be, deciding whose interests would be affected for better or worse, how much weight to attach to these things. All of this, again, depends on the sharing of information. Third need, public accountability. I guess this has a local California resonance, although don't think of it this way. This is perhaps a more dramatic, a sort of historic example. I think people are now thinking of perhaps Bell, California as another potential example of this, where the sharing of information is important to allow people to know what's being done in their name, with their resources, who's behind it. It's impossible for the public to hold, and I speak, you know, as a law professor at a public institution, I consider myself publicly accountable also. If the public doesn't know how their resources are being used, it's very hard for them to decide intelligently how to vote for the people who are spending those resources. And finally, information is necessary for communities to feel connected. People need information to be part of a narrative of the community. How do I fit in? You know, what's going on in this life of the community that I'm a part of, that I connect to, and how does it connect to my life? So these four functions are all absolutely critical. And unfortunately, we're living in a time where we have a media environment of unprecedented complexity, and some of that complexity turns out to be wonderful, and some is highly problematic. So the good news, as we all know, is that new media, digital media, offer people unprecedented avenues for sharing of information. People are actually looking at government websites. There was a 2010 survey by the Pew Internet and American Life Project. They're probably the most, the gold standard in doing communications research on how people use the internet. And they said fully 82% of internet users or 61% of all American adults, have looked for information or completed a transaction on a government website in the preceding year. 48% of Internet users have looked for information about a public policy or issue online with regard to their local, state, or federal government. And 35% research government statistics or documents. So that's a lot of people potentially looking for information about what you're doing online. And although there are challenges still to be overcome, in terms certainly of basic access, the digital divide, as it was called, which I think we could probably think of there being multiple digital divides. There are digital divides by income, there are digital divides by skill, there are digital divides by broadband access. We're not where we should be, but progress has been made. You know, things are better now than they were in the mid-90s. But there's also bad news. Part of the bad news, and I think a very big part of bad news, is the shrinkage in kind of the local core of journalists available to do basic reporting. I don't just mean, you know, the investigative stuff that wins Pulitzers, but even the basic beat reporting, the stuff that lets people know what went on at the school board meeting that they might not have had time to attend or what went on at the transportation hearing. Many places in the United States really have no good local news of any kind, no matter what the medium. I mean, they don't have newspaper coverage. Maybe they have a community weekly, maybe not. But radio, television is doing very little in terms of creating local knowledge. Now, people who celebrate the Internet say millions of flowers are blooming. There are many local websites being created, and indeed, there are many places where graduate students in journalism are going out and creating what amounts to a new local newspaper for, you know, some small area where they live. And a few of these online newspapers, of course, are succeeding pretty well, although none is succeeding entirely in a for-profit mode. But Voice of San Diego is, if you are in a conversation with people about online journalism, the three examples that always turn up of how it could be done right are Voice of San Diego, The Independent in New Haven, and MinPost in Minneapolis. But these are just three. Most local websites actually don't do very much to create new reporting, and they have fairly small audiences. And finally, there are these issues of both literacy and access. And when I say literacy, I don't just mean digital literacy. Although, if you talk to librarians now about how overwhelmed they are feeling with people coming into the libraries to learn how to use computers just to apply for jobs, and not having any idea of how to do this. The executive director of the Columbus Library tells a story about, he was talking to a young man who was helping on a volunteer basis to kind of staff their computer lab. Somebody said, you know, I need your help. I don't know if he was applying for Burger King or, you know, he's not applying for, you know, a major, a high-tech job. He's just a very basic minimum wage job, but the application had to be online. So the young man who was helping helped find the right web page, load the application, and he said to the person, so now we have the application. I'm going to go help somebody else while you fill this out, if that's okay. And the guy said, sure. When he came back, the client, the gentleman who had sought out his help, had taken out a Sharpie and filled the application out on the screen. And, you know, I'm probably one of the older people in the room, people in the room who are of our age, you know, there are lots of us who don't do computers. And when you find yourself, you know, out of work, limited in your resources, and desperate for connecting to this world, it can be a very difficult situation. When I talk about literacy, it's not just a matter, though, of digital literacy. Many cities in the United States, even native English-speaking populations have very difficult issues of adult literacy. And so for people to become engaged in their communities when they don't have access to media that they can use, media that is accessible to them, it just becomes a point of disconnection between them and the democracy in which they're supposedly living. It's important, I think, when you think about this, not to pretend that there is a golden age that we should be nostalgic for. There probably was, you know, even in the early 70s, when American journalism may have been at its peak in terms of resources, there were still many communities starved for news. And in the current situation, this is from the Knight Report, the Newspaper Association of America in 2007 counted up 1,422 newspapers, and you can add 6,700 or so community weeklies that were established in a different survey. Well, there are, as the census tells us, over 3,200 counties in the United States, 19,000 incorporated places, over 30,000 towns and villages. It just follows that there have to be towns and villages and maybe even counties that are really not being receiving any attention from daily journalism whatsoever. And that creates a big problem for governance. In thinking about why your city government, your county government, your local government needs to think strategically about communication, of course, you want to think about the four community needs that I've already mentioned, the need every community has for coordination, for problem solving, for public accountability, for a sense of connection. But it's also true that without information, you're losing out on potential support. People are not likely to support that which they do not understand and have not heard of. Information builds people's sense of identity. Information connects people to the place where they are. If you have a newspaper, if you have a robust media environment that reminds everybody, this is what you can do as a citizen of Columbus, this is what it means to be growing up in Brooklyn, this is what it means to be from New Orleans or Minneapolis or wherever you're from, over time that sinks in. And you know, a lot of things we do in life, we do not so much out of kind of conscious self-interest. We make a rational calculation. I will profit by this, so I'm going to do it. We do things because of who we think we are. And if you think you are a San Diegan, if you think you are a Pittsburgher, if you think you are a Baltimorean, then you are going to respond to the needs of your community differently than if you think you're, you know, somebody who just happens to live wherever you live but is not connected to the community. And so if the media is not building the information that creates a sense of local identity and government doesn't, this is also losing a tremendous source of potential for the community. Information, when people feel that they are informed, it engages them, it promotes their involvement with the community. And I think it can also be shown that better informed communities in a variety of respects are more successful communities. So that's the framework. So now the question is, what to do about it? And I've been doing some work. I've, again, been very fortunate to have been consulting with the Federal Communications Commission in part on the ways in which they're using new media. And the people who are there said, you know, well, we're going to divide the world in this way. And I found this a very useful way of thinking about the world of communication or information. As a government agency, we have a communication piece that we have to worry about. We have a data public records piece we have to worry about. And we have a participation engagement piece we have to worry about. And all I mean by that is that the agency or your city needs to figure out ways to tell your story better. You need to figure out ways of sharing the information you have that is of public value. And you have to come up with ways of inviting people into a dialogue with government. And I don't want to editorialize on this week beyond saying the following. I think if this week shows anything, it shows this. People want to feel that they are being listened to. And if the people who want government to work the people who are managing government are not reaching out to make people feel listened to, then the people who want government to stop will fill the vacuum. They will make sure that the people who are angry feel that they are being listened to. So if you need a case for doing this, the case is unless you engage with people, they're just not going to be standing with you when you need them. So in terms of communication, obviously the things to do here, and lots of governments, of course, are doing them already, are connecting to social media. The popular social media that undoubtedly you're well aware of, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. There are a variety of issues that have to be worked out legally when you set up service agreements with these organizations. Maybe you've already done this at the state level. The Government Services Administration at the federal level, I think, has worked out kind of model contracts so that at least federal government agencies know that they can sign on for a Facebook page and they're not going to have advertising on that page. They're not going to have any issues that will get them into legal problems. So there are problems, but they're eminently tractable problems. They're problems that can be resolved with an agreement that these folks are happy to sign because they want your traffic. And the FCC, which had not done this 2 years ago, now they are on Twitter. They are the third most popular government agency behind the White House and the Center for Disease Control. And the FCC firmly believes that if we could cure the swine flu, they'd be in number two position. The second thing you can do, if you have a website, you should be feeding it with fresh content, and you should allow people to subscribe to it. People should not have to come to your website to find its content in their inbox. There's a system, and again, now I'm telling you what you probably do know. It goes by the acronym of RSS for really simple syndication. If you install this on your website, basically it allows people to subscribe and get either on a reader that they can get free from Google or any of a number of places. They will get all the stories that you want them to read just when they turn on their computer. If you want people to know what you're doing, you have to go where they are. And where they are is their inbox. They're at their homepage. If they're not going to your webpage has to go to them. You should, and again, this is easy to do at very low cost, start streaming and archiving all your meetings, the public speeches that you're giving, the workshops that you're holding for the public to understand what's going on, so the people who could not be there in person because they were working or sick or taking care of someone or just, you know, their car broke down, they can find out what happened. And they can hear what you have to say. The FCC does all of this now at a website called fcc.gov/live. It's just a video archive of every event in which the commissioners are involved. Now, if your community, every community is facing a menu of issues that's immense. If there is an issue that's really focusing your community's attention, you might want to create a web page or a portal for information just on that issue so that if you're having an environmental issue or you're deciding on a school bond issue or whatever it is, instead of people having to go to, you know, cityofjonesmith.gov, they can go to that city/environment or city/schools and immediately become part of the discussion of the issue you want them to find. And the other way, of course, that agencies are communicating these days are through these things called blogs. You can think of blogs as kind of highly professionalized online diaries and sharing sites. But there are city managers who are doing this. There are government managers throughout the federal government who are doing this as a way, again, of sharing their story. And if you do this, you should make sure that people can subscribe to your blog so that they don't have to go to your blog to read your post. Your blog post finds its way to their computer. Examples, Long Beach is on Facebook. This is the Long Beach page. The city of Santa Rosa has a YouTube channel. And again, one advantage of the YouTube channel, now I'm sort of anticipating the participation piece, is of course you can also get citizens of your community to upload material about the community to your page. So it becomes a collective information sharing process. The Modesto police have a Twitter account, which is, you know, a very good way of getting the word out and hearing back quickly what's going on in the community. So all of these tools are really tools for, again, you know, making sure that your story is out there. Another thing to do, another thing to worry about, is this business of sharing the information you have. And I know this is scary to some people. It's probably scarier than it should be. And because people are scared, they're spending more time and more money on it than they should. Every state and the United States itself, of course, has a public records law that sounds great in principle. But for journalists, for citizens, for students, for anybody, acquiring public records, especially at the state and local level, is often very difficult and time-consuming. Not necessarily because people don't want to share, although sometimes that is going on, that there's actual resistance, but sometimes, you know, there's nobody in the office actually trained to respond to these requests, and they don't have the resources to do it. Well, one way you can make a life a lot easier on the public records front is to share proactively. Get into the position where instead of assuming that something should, you know, be in the back of a file cabinet until somebody asks for it, why not presume that it belongs online unless there's a good reason for not sharing it? And in that way, you know, the capacity of the community to access information and the time it would take you to respond to their requests will go down dramatically. Nobody, as far as I know, has done a rigorous, systematic study of all state and local websites in this respect. But there is an online project called sunshinereview.org that allows people to fill out a kind of survey for the city or the state in which they live, in which they look to find out whether their local website would allow them to access this information, the current budget, notices of public meetings, a roster of elected officials, performance audits, all of this stuff, which in principle ought to be public information. And they had, I forget how many thousands of people had responded at this point. There are many, many communities for which no survey has yet been taken, but there are many hundreds for which survey has been filled out. So far, there have been exactly 16 jurisdictions in the United States that, through their website, permit access to all of this information, as basic as it seems, which means that every time somebody in a community that doesn't offer its performance audits online, every time their city manager gets a request, they have to process that by hand. They have to actually respond to a letter. If they just put it online, all of that time and energy is saved. And this is perhaps the most critical piece in terms of accountability. You can also do very simple things to make your life easier and to make your community's life easier in terms of sharing information. I worked for a time at the Department of Justice. I love the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice shares many documents online in a way that makes me very proud to be part of a democracy, except that what they do is that they photograph the documents in a way that makes them not searchable. It's great to post. You can post all your documents in PDF formats. If you're posting them in a form that can't be searched, you are building in very high levels of frustration for anybody who's trying to study what you're doing. If you want to share information online, a really good thing to do is to gather it online. If you are letting people who have to fill out applications for various permits in your city do so with pen and ink, you are making it much harder to share the information they're providing with other citizens in the community. If you gather the information online, again, you will find it much easier, cheaper to share. So that's what I want to say about public records. On the data side, you may recognize this fellow. His name is Vivek Kundra. He's now the chief information officer at the White House. He was the chief technology officer for the District of Columbia. And D.C. Has what I think probably still is the gold standard in online data sharing by local government. There is this website. Oops. Why are we doing this? So this is the basic website, which provides kind of drop-down menu access to 29 different databases. I won't read them all, but you can find out who's making all the campaign contributions to people who are running for city office. You can search the D.C. city code. You can find government agencies. You can locate local businesses. Or if you get yet more ambitious, you can go to this website, which is called the Data Catalog, which actually makes available 436 data sets from different agencies, which allow people to download and process the data in multiple formats. In California, at least as far as I know, the leader in this sort of effort is San Francisco. Data SF is their equivalent of the DC data catalog. So why do this? Why share? I mean, and again, this sounds scary, right? I mean, all of the data about how you're performing is going to be public. Why would you do this? Well, for one thing, as a manager, you should understand that anything that is visible to the public has suddenly become visible to you. In terms of understanding what's going on with the people to whom you are delegating responsibility, if you have the data, you also have a much greater leverage over the performance of your administration. Also, what happens with these data is that private developers will create these small applications, nicknamed apps, that will allow people to use the information in valuable ways. So both New York and D.C. have had competitions for this. D.C. the program, I guess, is called Apps for Democracy, which actually offered a cash prize, and I'm reading their information, to the developer who could produce the most user-friendly applications based on government data. And they estimate that for $50,000 in prize money, they got applications that in their value for the city were worth $2.3 million because people want to use this stuff and they're willing to pay, you know, $1.99 or whatever to use it. As I mentioned before, people actually do look for this stuff. People are looking at government websites. People are starting to subscribe to government websites using their mobile devices, whether we're talking, you know, their cell phones, their iPhones, whatever it is. And that will increasingly be the platform that citizens want to use to connect with you. I think this data sharing can improve performance. And the story I want to tell is a story about the New York City public school system. Now, the New York City public school system actually was proactive in creating the data that it wanted to share. For the last 4 years, they had been doing a survey which they offered to every parent, every teacher, and every student sixth grade or older in the city of New York to answer a variety of questions about the performance of their school. And these data are collected. They are disseminated both in the form of an aggregate report for the city, but they are also collected as school-specific reports. So you can go online for your school, or if you're thinking of moving to an area, you can get that report. And they summarize this to show you how much of a risk they were willing to take. They actually gave each school a grade based on these survey responses. So, who picked up on this immediately? Realtors, because this became, if you were living in a neighborhood where they had an A school, this became a big selling point. So they don't have, of course, the money to do the kind of rigorous social science research that would, you know, get somebody a PhD. But they did notice this. Scores on both English and math have been going up pretty steadily in New York City since 2000. And you can see the yellow line refers to the scores, and the blue line is the gap between the average New York City score and the average score in the rest of the state. So as the city scores are going up, the gap, of course, is going down. And you will notice that they gave me a pointer. So right here, it looks like there's a sharp acceleration in this trend. Again, we don't have the social science to prove this. It does happen to be that this is when the survey started. Now, it may be that because we don't have a kind of social science investigation, we don't actually know why this is happening. It may be that, you know, parents are becoming actively involved in using the information. It may be that, you know, newspaper reporters are using it. Or it may be what I think of as the police car on the side of the road effect. You know, if people think they're being watched, they tend to behave better. And that may be true for principals as well. Well, one thing that they found by doing the survey, by the way, and last year, over roughly 50% of all the parents in the New York City public school system responded to the survey. Think about the last thing you did that had a 50% response rate. 94% of the parents who responded, on average, said that they were satisfied or extremely satisfied with their children's teachers or the school. And what's interesting is, if you look at their more nuanced views of particular programs, they had lots of criticisms. But they were hugely supportive. Why? Because they thought they were being listened to. And the schools that had the biggest improvement by using these data are the schools that took these reports and used these as a basis for public meetings where they could engage the parents in conversation about what was happening in the schools. Participation, if you want to call it that, engagement, this is the last piece of the information initiative story. Engaging people in conversation, reporting to them, getting their feedback, and perhaps in the most advanced form, actually allowing the community to deliberate together about solving what seemed to be intractable problems in the community. This is a British example. I just love the name of the website, talkswindon.org. This is just a simple threaded bulletin board in which people in this particular town can go talk about the issues. What's great, it's very user-friendly, it's very easy to use. If there's a downside, it's not obvious how this is connected to actual decision-making, but people might well appreciate it. But again, if you want something like this to have its maximum value, people have to feel that you're actually paying some attention to it. That doesn't mean you're necessarily doing what they tell you to do, but you're taking into account what they're saying. The Spokane Library hosts a blog for city government, which again is another, I mentioned that the blog is a way in which you can tell your story. A blog is also a way in which you can invite citizens of your community to share their comments. And it becomes a participatory forum as well. The city of Davis actually has a wiki. A wiki is an online collaborative text. The most famous wiki, of course, is Wikipedia, every line of which is absolutely true. Maybe not. But on the other hand, you can find out a lot of things that turn out to be true a lot faster using Wikipedia than many other information sources. David Carr, who's a media critic for the New York Times, made a bet, I think, in the year 2000 with a fellow reporter whether 5 years down the road, the most highly trafficked news story, according to the Associated Press, they do this inventory every year, what are the 10 biggest stories in terms of how many people have read this? They made a bet. Would it be a story that was printed in the newspaper, or was it a story that was printed in a blog? David, being a new media guy, bet on the blog. The New York Times guy bet on the newspaper. They were both wrong. The most frequented news site in 2005 was a wiki page. And so, again, if you want people to participate, to share what they know and make it part of what the community knows, there is a way of doing it. There are ways of actually simulating some of the headaches that you go through to share with your fellow citizens. This is, a town in England that has a wonderful name of Whatchester. It's amazing we revolted against these guys because, really, they have very good town names. But basically, it gives people in the town the opportunity to try to make the budget work and to form an opinion about the trade-offs that they are happy with based upon the actual visualization of what the trade-off would be. It turns out you can't have 10% more of anything and lower your revenues by 10%. It just doesn't work. A very popular website that people are using in a variety of communities, CClickFix, is a way of allowing people to point out geolocated problems, geographically located problems on a website that the community then can respond to. And this effectively turns the public into reporters, where they can let you know where are the potholes that need repair, where's the garbage that needs to be picked up, where's the graffiti that could usefully be painted over. All of these are ways, all of the techniques that I mentioned are pretty simple, low-cost ways of enabling people to have a say. The most advanced, in a way, but I don't want to say, you know, all of these things are important. I don't necessarily want to say this is the most important, but a distinctively different and particularly challenging, and when it works, especially rewarding thing you can do with your citizens, I almost said students, is to invite them to deliberate. And the person who probably knows more about municipal deliberation than anybody else in the U.S. is right here in California. He's at Stanford. He's a wonderful political scientist named Jim Fishkin. I won't comment about whether it costs a lot to have him work with you, but he has a book out that doesn't cost a lot that explains the process. He's created a process called deliberative polling. He calls it deliberative polling because he was sick of these polling exercises where people, where you get a telephone call and you're asked, you know, what's your opinion of X, Y, and Z, and you know you answer even though you've never thought about this. It was shown in a famous experiment in the mid-70s that I think by Gallup, they called up to find out whether people were for or against the Good Government Act of 1975. It turns out people were largely in favor of it, although there were a lot of people who didn't want it. There was, of course, no such statute. To celebrate the 20th anniversary, I think, or the 25th anniversary, I think it was the Washington Post replicated the poll, asking whether people supported the repeal of the Good Government Act of 1975. And, of course, not only did this produce a result, but the result was easily manipulable because you could get a different result simply by saying, President Clinton is trying to repeal the Good Government Act of 1975. How do you feel? Or Newt Gingrich is trying to and this completely changed the result because people knew nothing about a Good Government Act, this non-existent statute, but they were just picking up a signal from the question. So Jim said, could we have a process where we actually gave people a fair opportunity to understand the thing that they were being asked about? And the process, it's a kind of day-long structured conversation. It involves creating balanced briefing materials ahead of time, but there is a method. It's not that hard to do. It does involve the community actually in producing the information. And what's exciting about it is that people really respond positively to the experience. I attended one of these in New Haven where the question was a question about whether there should be tax sharing between the suburbs and the city in the county in which New Haven is situated. And by the end of the day, this is a randomly, these aren't self-selected people. This is a randomly recruited sample of the population, just like the Gallup poll would be a scientifically assembled random sampling. After they talked about the issue, there was very significant opinion change from the beginning to the end of the day, where people in the wealthier parts of the county began to perceive that there would be real economic benefits to them from tax sharing, which they had not, it just had never occurred to them before. And even people who disagreed by the end of the day were answering, you know, do you feel better, worse, or the same about people you disagree with? The answer was, well, I have a lot more respect for people I disagree with. Now I understand what they're talking about. So this can be an enormously important community building exercise. The center he's created is called, and I get no commission for this, by the way, he works out of something he's created called the Center for Deliberative Democracy, and he highlights the various things he's done around the world. He has done at least one California deliberation, which was in San Mateo County. This was an assembly to decide what to do about difficult choices in public house, about the housing shortage in the county. And again, if you're interested in more information about this, I'm sure he would be, well, you can find it online, and he would be happy to talk to you. There are other models for doing this. There's the America Speaks model, which often involves, at least at the outset, larger numbers of people. It is self-selected. It's not random, so it may not have the same representative quality. But there's a lot of energy and good output that comes from those experiences. There are other things you can find out about called citizens' juries, participatory budgeting. You Google these phrases, and you will be awash in information. And I guess the last thing I want to share with you is, in fact, you can learn a lot about what's going on in the world through online resources that are available to you free. Again, I don't know if these slides have been distributed to people. If not, I'm happy to help make that happen or to respond to any requests. But just to mention some of the organizations, the National Coalition for Deliberation and Dialogue, Involve, which is a very similar organization. It operates in the UK, but they have done a really wonderful guide to all the different models of deliberation, and except that, you know, they spell labor, O-U-R. It's a perfectly fine and helpful guide. The Government Services Administration in Washington puts out a set of what they call their Intergovernmental Solutions newsletters that are just superb in terms of giving you concrete examples of what governments around the country and around the world are doing, often at the local level, in terms of these participation initiatives. This is a Public Policy Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Has done a very good report on making the most of social media. There's a Center for Technology and Government at SUNY Albany. Tomorrow morning, I think there's a program that's going to feature a guy named Steve Clift. Steve is, I don't know how he would describe himself. I think of him as a democracy entrepreneur. He's the Johnny Appleseed of electronic democracy. He's going around the world explaining to communities how they can do stuff online to engage the public and to produce more successful community outcomes. He has a listserv at edemocracy.org. It is free. It is invaluable. There will be something crossing your desk every week that you will find applicable to your work. It's just amazing what a successful network he's put together, and again, it costs nothing. He actually has a page on his website called Local Government 2.0 that aggregates in one place sites to many, many reports that are directly relevant to local government and would be available to you. And if you want yet more examples, these folks who are Canadians, they have not only do they have health care, they have e-government. And they put together I didn't show this to you because there are actually, I think, 107 slides, but they put together a kind of slide presentation on municipal open government, and it includes many very specific examples of what cities are doing in Canada that are eminently replicable in the United States in terms of this business of information, data sharing, and public outreach. So, again, I'm hoping that that this is of help to you. The Knight Commission came to the conclusion that a community that really wanted to have a healthy information environment needed to worry about three things. One thing it has to worry about is whether the community has within its networks of communication the information you actually need. I mean, does anybody know what you need to know? Or are there ways of getting the data that you need to know to solve the problems that you have or achieve the objectives that you have? So obviously, key to the communication environment is information. The second thing to worry about is capacity. Do people in the community have the capacity to be effective producers, consumers, distributors, analysts, sharers of information, both in terms of just their basic skills and also access to the relevant technologies? So we call that capacity. And then the third part is engagement. Are people within your community given the opportunities and provided the motivations to engage with information and with each other to accomplish important public purposes? These three things, information, capacity, and engagement, form the acronym ICE. And I don't know, that's a cool way to conclude. So I hope you're thinking about those things for your community, and I hope this has been of help to you. The commission concluded its report by saying that in conformed communities, like democracy itself, really are a vision always to be pursued. It's not a final state of perfection ever likely to be achieved. But our first call is for an outpouring of additional ideas, dialogue, and action in communities throughout the United States. The information issue is everyone's issue. And I guess I would just like to say thank you for allowing me to share my ideas. And as I say, I hope there are some help in the work that you're doing, which really does provide democracy what backbone it has in the United States. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Peter, and it's you have had stimulated us many ways about, I was writing down a ton of notes, and then Joanne reminded me that actually, in fact, all of the slides from all of the sessions, including this one, are going to be online. So if you'd like to have access to these slides, they will be available for you. This conversation will also continue this afternoon over in the Convention Center. According to the schedule, I think it's room 28 at the Convention Center. Professor Shane and Sam Rodriguez from Comcast will both be together at 3:15 to continue this conversation if you'd like to engage further in dialogue about this. I also wanted to acknowledge, where is Terry Amsler in the room? Where's Terry? Terry, over here, who's leading our own collaborative governance initiatives here at the Institute. And if you go on the Institute's website, you'll be able to see the materials that they're also producing, which will be useful to you. And then last but not least, where is table six? You're the winner of the trivia contest. I want to thank you for coming, and let's give one last round of applause to Professor Shane for his comments today. Thank you. You're dismissed, and have a nice walk back.